Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com, and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, brain hackers. We're delving deep into the brain right now to actually tell you how shopping centers of all sorts, like grocery stores, actually brainwash you into buying stuff you perhaps don't need by using psychology and brain science. And we're talking to a behavioral psychologist and, in fact, chief behavioral officer for a company that works solely on this. And you're going to find out the dirty little secrets of how they lay out a grocery store and department store to get you to buy. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're talking. So you're Michael Barbera, and you tell us your title here as Chief Behavioral Officer. What is that?
So Chief Behavioral Officer is responsible for the data analytics and the psychology behind how consumers make decisions, but also how employees make decisions as well. So both the internal and external parts of an organization.
So can you actually predict consumer behavior to a certain extent, like not individuals, but en masse? You can pretty much predict how much they're going to go after, say, a Black Friday special, or if you change the color of a bottle of soap, you can predict how much they're going to buy it. How accurate can you get with this?
We can get pretty close. We can get very close, nearly down to the individual. Now, of course, humans are very unpredictable, and we tend to also differ from our normal habits and patterns. So as we can get pretty close, it's still not a perfect system.
Yeah, now is there something about, okay, first of all, we'll get into, tell us like the three or four things that people just don't know that might surprise them about how a grocery store is laid out, something that they've always seen and they didn't know why it was like that.
All right, so let's start when you walk into the grocery store. When you enter a grocery store, more than likely, one of the first things you're going to see are flowers. Flowers are fresh, they don't live very long. So it tells you that when you enter that store, cognitively, you're now thinking, well, if the flowers are fresh, everything beyond here are now fresh as well, too.
Step number two. That's a confirmation bias. If you have something that you expect, you confirm it later on when you go through. Nice.
Exactly. All right, we're talking behavioral economics. I like it. You're all over it. As you continue to enter that store, you now come into the produce section, and you might see a chalkboard sign that says apples, 69 cents per pound, whatever the price may be. And you're thinking, well, you know what? It's written in chalk. It changes each day. It changes with the market. But most people don't know is that sign is not actually written in chalk. It looks like it's written in chalk, but it was printed by a printer at some other manufacturing facility. So it's just make it look fresh. That's number two. So
that also appeals to people's desire now for shopping local. But what you're saying is they're faking that. The things are coming from Chile or wherever they come from, and they put a little chalkboard sign to make it look like it's a local like flea market, and it's not.
Correct. So because we believe that if things are fresher, we're more likely to buy it. We want to be fresh. Organizations, especially grocery stores, want to target individuals for who they are now and who they want to be. We all like to eat Oreos now, but we all want to be the individual that eats healthy and lives a healthier lifestyle, although behavior change is challenging. And so regardless of where the apples come from, I wasn't going to use this as my third fact, but I'll share this because it's pretty good. The average age of an apple in a grocery store is 14 months.
Now, is that 14 months from being picked?
14 months from being picked.
Okay, so it was picked green and then it matured in a box.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the type of apple you got, it could still stay green if you got a green apple.
Yeah. So continue on. Tell us some of the other surprising facts.
All right. So we zip through the aisles. We grab our things. We fill up our cart. We get to the checkout aisle. Once we're in the checkout aisle, this is the point of the decision where if I'm not going to buy something, if I say something is going to come out of my cart, this is where it's going to happen. So when you're in the checkout aisle, you have checkout lane, checkout lane, checkout lane, checkout lane. And in between those lanes, you have these little kiosks or racks. You have gum, candy bars, sodas, depending on the aisle, you might even have batteries. Now, 10, 15 years ago, these items had a flat top shelf where there may be like a fridge and it was a flat top. And you're like, you know what? I didn't really want this bottle of milk. So I'm going to place this milk on top of this this flat top, right? So now it just sits there. Now, if you go to the grocery store today, more than likely you're going to see an A-frame where the candy racks or battery racks end at a point because it's not a flat surface. So if the consumer doesn't have a place to place the items they do not want, they're going to more than likely purchase them because it's not socially acceptable to put your gallon of milk onto the floor. So let's do the quick little math. 15 cash out registers or point of sales per grocery store. One item per hour with a median cost of $3, 24 hours of operation, 365 a year. That's a lot of money saved or earned, depending on how you look at it, just by changing the design of the A-frame at the candy rack.
Mm-hmm. And also, I would say also that it's also an advertising thing in that if I have like a jug of milk sitting on top of that thing, then everybody behind me gets in kind of incentivized that it's socially okay to not buy everything that's in your cart, and more people do it. So you're getting rid of that primacy factor.
Absolutely, because the most persuasive thing we could do is show that other people are doing it too. So if everyone else is putting items down, well, I may want to put it down as well too. If I was driving across a bridge and I saw a bunch of people jumping off of it, I may not jump off the bridge, but I promise you I'll pull over and at least look over and be curious about what is going on.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of just some simple things like Walmart. Walton himself, who founded Walmart, he figured out that he could dramatically reduce theft, not by adding more security, that didn't seem to deter, but by adding a greeter. Just have somebody who says hi to you on the way in. It's this feeling of, oh, okay, I actually interacted with somebody, now I can't get away with stuff. And it was the weirdest thing, you know? And mind you, the greeter also is supposed to check your receipt on the way out, but that's actually kind of a new thing. In the beginning, they saw a huge reduction in theft by having nothing more than adding a greeter versus just, you know, no greeter at the end.
That's phenomenal because what you're doing is you're making it more humanizing. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer, I'm going to steal this $5 item from Walmart from a large organization. I'm now stealing it from Ted, the greeter. So for example, whenever I call someone that I may not know, say I call customer support for an electronic product that I own, they may answer like, welcome to Acme Organization. This is Sarah speaking. How can I help you? Hey, Sarah, this is Michael Barbera. The first thing I do is I identify myself and make myself sound like a human because I'm more likely to receive better quality customer service if I were to identify myself as a human.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds kind of odd, like everybody's a human, but you're right. The internet's a perfect example of how people can treat each other so horribly when there's a level of anonymity. We believe that all of a sudden what we're talking to is a caricature of a person, not a real person. And thus, you know, we can be jerks or whatever. All right. So continue on with some of these surprising facts about what we do in a store.
Okay. So in a grocery store, we like to buy the things that make us happy. So let's go to our favorite aisle, the cereal aisle. Now, for those who have children, we all know that, and you're probably going to nod your head back and forth as a no, but I promise you that when you're in the cereal aisle and you have small children with you, the parent is not in control of the decision-making process because the
and we've all been really don't go into the cereal aisle with the boy at all. We just don't.
Right, you order the cereal from Amazon, or you skip it when the children are at school.
Yeah, well, we pick it up when they're not there, and like they know the cereal, but just don't even bother because it's right at their eye level, is what you're saying, right? The sugary, the really sugary stuff is right there.
Oh, I haven't even got to that part yet. That's even better. So, as you go into the cereal aisle, first, a parent is more likely to make a purchase to appease the child to avoid looking like a bad parent in public. Now, we come to the design of the shelves. So typically, it's usually about 5 levels of shelving in a cereal aisle. Now, of course, you put the children's cereal at child eye level and the healthier cereal towards the top or at the adult eye level. But if you look at the Trix cereal box with the rabbit on there, mm-hmm. The Trix rabbit was designed by an artist this very similar way that the Mona Lisa was designed. So if I was the Trix rabbit, if you walk to my left or walk to my right, my eyes or the rabbit's eyes will follow you no matter where you go.
That's a very creepy cereal box now that I think about it, but subconsciously it makes the children pay attention. That's awesome. All right, give us a couple other ones like that people would really be surprised by.
We extended that one early. Here's a common one that most people are probably aware of is the milk. And milk's usually towards the back of the grocery store. So is bread. It's one of the two of the most common items that are purchased. So if you have to walk all the way through the grocery store just to get those two most common items, you're going to pick up other items and put them into your cart. Now, we look at a cart, right? Typically, we have the standard large cart and you push it along. And then some grocery stores have that smaller cart, maybe with two tiers. So you have your standard large cart. And the reason why that cart is that size is because even if you're going to go pick up two items, or I'm just going to run in and get those five items real quick. What's going to happen is when you put those five items in that cart, it looks so small and it leaves so much more room to fill up regardless of what you went in there for. And we've all said that key phrase, like, I just came here for milk. Yeah, you walk out with $140 in groceries and a cart that's keeping over the sides.
Right. So what about the smaller carts?
The smaller carts are there. So the smaller carts are designed to make you feel like that you are making a smart decision. You're only going to buy a few items, but then it comes with two tiers. And when you map out the cubic square inches of the cart, the size, it's not much smaller than the actual larger cart.
So you end up filling up that smaller cart, and you actually would have filled up the larger cart in the same way, and you end up buying the same amount of stuff.
Very near to it, yes.
All right. So what about the product, the design of products? So there's a lot of people who talk about, you know, the design of women's products. Like, they always have, like, dragonflies and butterflies on them. They're always pink, and everyone's annoyed by that. And, you know, the design of cleaning products, you know, that there's always like pictures of rain or doves or whatever. And but like, there's all these tropes that people seem to be so annoyed by, but I'm thinking they don't exist without a reason, right? So tell us about some of those concepts.
So the assumption is that when a product is designed, it was done like that for a reason that the company is aware of. We hope and we advocate that organizations make objective decisions based upon data and evidence. You also want to antagonize your non-customers. So if, I think it was about a year ago now, a pen company made a pink pen designed for ladies. And of course, a lot of people are outraged. Why is this pen pink? We can use any color we want. Pink, it doesn't be synonymous with the female gender. Okay. But what that did was, that company more than likely was aware of a target audience of females that buys their products who would love a pink pen. So they're appealing to their target audience, but they're also antagonizing their non-target audience, because what happens there is you get press and media and people talk about you. The perfect example of that is Nike's recent Colin Kaepernick ad.
Yes, the Colin Kaepernick thing, yeah.
Nike knows who their target audience is and they know who are not. So they knew by using Colin Kaepernick and using this ad that they would increase sales by those who are passionate about their brand, passionate about what they stand for, but they also knew they would intentionally antagonize those who would not typically buy their product. And that's okay, because even though those people were not going to buy their products, they're now talking about Nike, and Nike is a topic of conversation not only between individuals, but in the news.
Yeah, no, and it becomes this crazy wedge issue. I was talking a lot about it as a PR guy, and it's they were completely genius about it. If you look at the demographics, Nike skews to the Black community in a big way, and minorities. It also skews, of course, towards sports fans in a big way. But its demographics skew right in the direction that the fans of Colin Kaepernick were skewing. The interesting thing is people who buy every Nike product, they're usually basketball fans more than they are football fans. You know, football fans are also, so in other words, they're pissing off a bunch of, let's call them NASCAR fans, to get a bunch of NBA fans on their side. Well, those are the people who are their core audience. So it was this amazing, you know, brilliant coup, I thought, that, they inserted themselves. And so that's a tough thing to deal with, because once you get into politics, sometimes it can backfire. And there's a lot of people who think they're really, really smart, and then it screws up. But this one was a good one.
So that's actually a really significant catch-22 for organizations in our current climate. So we both know that it's very challenging for an organization to take a political stance. What if it's the wrong one? Who will you offend? Customers in 2018, 2019 and beyond, they want their organizations, their brands, because people don't buy from organizations, they buy from brands. They want their brands to have a voice. They want their brands to take a stand. So they're more than likely to associate, engage, and buy from brands when they take a political stance or a stance in key social issues. Yeah. It's challenging. It's what is the right one? And
the interesting thing is, like, the people who did that really well before Nike were on the other side of the political spectrum. I'm talking about Chick-fil-A when they took a big political stance. That was one of the first ones that there was this big, at least one of the first ones in this modern era of divisive politics, let's say. During the Obama administration, Chick-fil-A took a, I don't remember what it was, but they took a controversial stance. And Chick-fil-A is like Christian sort of chicken, I guess, Christian chicken. And it's like, it's not even, there's no restaurants where I am at, but it's good chicken when I've traveled. And like they close down every Sunday for the Sabbath, things like that. Anyways, there was this huge boycotting campaign, and it turned out that their sales more than doubled because, you know, they are mostly in the South, and they really, you know, followed through on that. Same thing happened with Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby, you know, fought the that one Obamacare thing about birth control, and they didn't suffer because of it. Their sales went through the roof. There's a lot of different examples like that. But it has to be, you know, your core audience.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.